Hugh Sinclair tells the story. Charles B. Cochran wrote of Gertrude Lawrence, "She is, without a particle of doubt, the most glittering star of the English-speaking stage." Coming from Cochran, that was high tribute, but it was a true assessment. More than any other actress of her day, Gertrude Lawrence had star quality. She looked like a star, she acted like a star. In the midst of her friends, there was no one who was more relaxed, more unassuming. But when the public were around, to see her come out of a stage door was like seeing a queen leaving her coronation. Now, the story we're going to tell is a Cinderella story. The story of a woman whose childhood was spent in South London, and who became, by courage, by hard work, by determination, and by talent, one of the great international stars of her time. Gertrude's real name was Gertrude Alexandra Dagmar Lawrence Clayson. She was born in London on the 4th of July, 1898. Her father was a Danish-born bass singer whose professional name was Arthur Lawrence, and who was well known in the smaller music halls and at the smoking concerts of suburban London. Her mother was a chorus girl. When Gertrude was two, her parents separated. Now, her first professional engagement was at the age of 10. Her mother took a pantomime engagement at Brixton, 30 shillings a week. Gertrude was a Robin Redbreast in a children's ballet, 6 shillings a week. Gertrude pleaded with her mother to send her once a week to a dancing school, Miss Italia Conti's school, but the budget did not allow for such extravagances. However, Miss Conti interviewed Gertrude and thought her promising enough to give her 3 lessons. As one of the Italia Conti pupils, she appeared in 2 children's plays, one at Liverpool and one at Manchester, and both directed by Basil Dean. And she was one of the 100 children who appeared in the great spectacle, which was produced by Max Reinhardt and Charles Cochran at Olympia, The Miracle, with Humperdinck's music.
Thank you.
Among her fellow pupils was a master Noel Coward, and someone else who was to be a friend throughout her career, a master Roy Royston. Do you remember the first time you met her, Roy?
Oh, very well indeed. We met in the basement of a pub just off Portland Place, where we were rehearsing for a play that was called Fifinella up in I think it was Liverpool.
Mm. How did she strike you?
Oh, well, she struck you rather forcibly, even as a child. She had a funny little turned-up nose, sparkling little eyes. She seemed to give you an idea that she was rather a cockney, pert little sparrow in many ways. Mm. But I think the thing that's struck me more than I can say is, I think, her voice. Mm. Also, of course, she had a great gift of imitation. Having that, which I think every good artist should have, she was very, to begin with, a very quietly dressed little girl. She didn't know much about dress, but she became, I think, one of the best dressed women on the English stage, and a great credit to her profession.
She was indeed. Well, thank you very much indeed, Roy. Now, from the age of 13 onwards, Gertrude played on tour with countless musical comedies and third-rate revues. It's very likely that some of our listeners in Shrewsbury were once served by Gertrude Lawrence when she put in an enforced spell as a barmaid at the Red Lion there. That was after the manager of the show she was in at the Old Theatre Royal had absconded with the takings and stranded the company. Then one night, when she was playing at Swindon, an American couple, Lee White and Clay Smith, came round to the stage door to see her. They had spotted an unusual personality, a great potential talent. They said they would try to help. Well, it was almost a year later when she was playing at Yarmouth that a telegram arrived saying that they had recommended her for a part in a new revue that André Charlot was putting on at the Vaudeville Theatre. Come at once, they said. Well, first came a frantic rush round, borrowing a shilling here and sixpence there until she had her fare. Then the anxious business of the audition. And then her first appearance in the West End, in Some.
Seen the ducks go by for their morning walk, waddling along Mumbai. You should hear them talk. There's the marduk, the parduk, the grand old drink, leading the way. What a noise they make! You can hear them when you're near them, for a mile or two sky high. Have you seen the ducks once more? Come a-rolling feeling very sad and sore as the lanes they roam. On the pond they are fond, but they stay too long, winding the time with wine and song. Have you seen them? Have you seen them? Have you seen those ducks go by?
André Charlot gave her a 3-year contract, starting at £3.10 a week. And she appeared in several of his wartime reviews. They were simply staged, intimate shows relying on wit, talent, and good taste. Now, the Charlot show that followed Some was called Cheap, and it featured a song that has survived through the years. Show, Gertrude Lawrence was given more and more to do. She was appointed understudy to Beatrice Lilly, and thus became a firm and indissoluble friendship. It was through that friendship that Gertie was given her first real chance, when they were both playing in Tabs. In her dressing room at the Broadhurst Theatre in New York, Beatrice Lilly recorded this story for us.
Well, I'd like to tell you how Gertrude Lawrence got her first start. We were both playing at the Vaudeville Theater, one of Charlot's reviews. I think it was called Tabs. Yes, I'm sure it was. And, of course, I'm a very healthy type. Never miss a performance, not me. So I was on every night for a year. There was Gertrude waiting to go on. So I relented after the end of the year and said, well, I'll stay off one night and Gertie can go on. So I stayed off and had somebody call Mr. Charlot, say I had a very, very high fever and must stay in bed, but hope to be back the next evening. Well, the next day I felt fine, as I did the day before. No fever at all. So I thought I'd go and see a show I'd always wanted to see called Chu Chin Chow. So I went to see Chu Chin Chow. And sitting right next to me was, guess who? Charlot. Was my face red? And did my fever really go up? It certainly did. That's not me. That's my little doggie. Well, he suspended me for 2 weeks without pay. And there you are, 2 weeks. I thought I'd never get back. Well, Gertrude was so good at my part, it was touch and go if they'd ever have me again.
After Tabs came Buzz Buzz, which introduced another famous song, Kukukukate.
So cute to meet, no one could be just as cute and sweet. That's what Jimmy thought when the wedding ring he bought. Dinky little home and all complete. Jimmy thought he'd like to take a chance. His heart did a sort of song and dance, stepping to a tune all about the silvery moon. Jimmy followed up his first advance. Kukukukate, beautiful Katie, you're the only girl that I adore. Oh, when the moon shines on the cacao shed, I'll be waiting at the kukukukate door.
Gertie had flung herself wholeheartedly into the restless, hectic life of wartime London. She had very speedily acquired A, expensive tastes, B, a husband about 20 years older than she was, and C, in due course, a daughter, Pamela. Pamela, now married to a successful sculptor, Robert Clatworthy, and living in Sussex, is in the studio with us. Tell me, Pam, how do you remember your mother?
I think that one of the most vivid memories of her is that she was terribly remote in real life. One could never quite get to her.
Yeah.
And yet on the stage, she suddenly came very close to me. And, she was so beautiful. Yeah. I never saw her looking disheveled. And everything around her was terribly neat and orderly. Mm, she
gloss,
hated disorder.
Mm. Mm.
Another thing, she just couldn't sit still indoors. She was always getting up and moving this and moving that or changing the room around. She always had the radio on. She adored soap operas, you know, these endless serials like Stella Dallas and things like that in the States. She liked light music. She thought Bach was busy.
Mm.
I think she was a bit sorry that she couldn't read Shakespeare. I think she just said he was unreadable, and I think that she felt that a lot of things were barred to her because she'd never had the educational opportunities that she was able to give me, for instance.
Mm.
Oh, I know another thing that used to bother me a bit. She loathed going anywhere by bus or underground. I think that it all went with having been terribly poor as a child and having lived in unpleasant surroundings. She really loved luxury. It represented to her success.
Yes.
Although she was such a party girl by all accounts, I don't think she really liked parties.
I don't think
much.
She did, no.
And she certainly hated giving them. In fact, I can't remember her ever giving one.
Mm. Thank you, Pamela Clatworthy. Now, let's go back now to the 1920s. In 1921, in A to Z at the Prince of Wales Theatre, Gertrude Lawrence was starred for the first time. And a couple of years later, she was to meet again one of her fellow pupils at the Italia Conti School when she starred with Noel Coward in his own review, London Calling.
Parisian hero, society's hero, Lord of the day, we're
The following year, André Charles was invited to take a review to New York. He selected some of the best numbers from his London reviews, assembled a cast headed by some of the stars whose talents he'd himself developed, Beatrice Lilly, Gertrude Lawrence, Jack Buchanan, and Charles's review of 1924 opened at the Times Square Theatre, New York. It was a triumph, and the British stars found themselves the toasts of the city. Gertie made an outstanding success with a song by Douglas Fairbairn and Philip Graham, originally sung in A to Z by Teddy Gerrard, Limehouse Blues.
Oh, Limehouse Kid, oh, Limehouse Kid, going the way that the rest of them did. Poor broken blossom and nobody's child. Haunted and taunted, you're just kind of wild. Oh, Limehouse Blues, I've the real Limehouse Blues. Learn from the Chinkies, those sad China blues. Rings on my fingers and tears for a crown. That is a story of old Chinatown.
And another song of Goethe's was You Were Meant for Me.
Oh, you were meant for me.
Review was afterwards played in London for a season. And then the company returned to New York with a new edition, Charlotte's Review of 1926. There were some changes among the smaller fry in the company. For example, I was in it. I remember so well on the boat going over, asking Gertie and Jack where they were going to stay. They said the Ambassador in Park Avenue. I said, all right, I'll stay there too, I think. Now, I'd never been to New York before. I didn't know the hotel, and I certainly didn't know the cost of living. Well, at the end of the first week, I found my bill was $100, so I moved out quickly. It wasn't until long afterwards that I discovered that it had really been $300, and Gertie had paid the difference, so that I wouldn't get too big a shock. Well, that was the kind of thing she did. Among the numbers in which I worked with Gertie in the 1926 show was Noel Coward's Poor Little Rich Girl. And the extraordinary thing was that this song hadn't originated in a Charlotte show at all, but in a review which Coward had written for Charles B. Cochran, On With the Dance.
Poor little rich girl, you're a bewitched girl, better beware. Laughing at danger, but to a stranger, better take care. The life you lead sets all your nerves a-jangle. Your love affairs are in a hopeless tangle. Though you're a child, dear, your life's a wild title. In life's pleasure, the craze for pleasure steadily grows. Cocktails and laughter, but what comes after, nobody knows. You're weaving love into a mad jazz pattern, ruled by pantaloons. Poor little rich girl, don't drop a stitch too soon.
The 1926 Charlotte show ran for 6 months. One thing I remember that staggered Broadway was the way our two leading ladies behaved backstage. Now, the common experience had always been that when you had two leading ladies in a show, you ran for cover. Well, in our case, not only were they good friends, but they even insisted on sharing a dressing room. And when the show finished in New York, we toured across the United States, ending with a quite fabulous 3 weeks in Hollywood. I remember that on our closing night, we found to our great surprise that our chorus line in the finale had some extra people in it. They included Rudolph Valentino, the Marx Brothers, Charlie Chaplin, and Ronald Coleman. What a night that was. Gertie had decided to leave Charlotte's management. She'd been with him nearly 10 years and go back into New York into a show which George and Ira Gershwin had written songs specially for her. This was OK.
There's somebody I'm longing to see. That he turned out to be someone to watch over me. I'm a little lamb who's lost in the wood. I know I could always be good to one who'd watch over me. Although he may not be the
After the New York run of OK, Gertie played again in London at His Majesty's. In the cast there was an old friend of ours, Claude Hulbert. Tell me, Claude, what are your memories of Gertie?
Well, I only had the pleasure of playing with her once in OK.
Mm.
And then, unfortunately, never had the chance of knowing her really well. You see, we hardly met in the show, and I was always a rather shy sort of bloke, I'm afraid.
Mm.
And, well, with she, as you know, she was the complete opposite. Always so gay, with a bon mot always ready on her lips, that I contented myself with just admiring her from the wings.
Mm.
Well, I often stood counting myself a very lucky person to be with such a great artist.
I envy you.
Gertie was theatre. Her suite of dressing rooms, her mother, always acting as hostess for her, at her many receptions after the show, footlights, champagne, glamour. That was Gertie.
It was indeed. Well, thank you, Claude, very much indeed. By now, of course, she was really in the money, and her extravagance had to be seen to be believed. She didn't just buy a car, she had one built. She returned to New York for another Gershwin show, Treasure Girl, but this one wasn't a success. She stayed over there for two more productions, a straight play, By Candlelight, in which she played opposite Leslie Howard, and The International Review, in which her co-stars were Harry Richman and another old boy of the Italia Conti School, Anton Dolin. In this show, Gertrude had two wonderful numbers, On the Sunny Side of the Street and Exactly Like You. hotel bedroom in Tokyo, Noel Coward had been working on a play. It had all begun with a vision of Gertie in a white Molyneux gown on a terrace in the south of France. And this vision became a famous and profitable play in which they were to act together both in London and New York. Private Lives.
What exactly were you remembering at that moment?
Lots of things.
So was I.
What fools we were to ruin it all. What utter fools.
We were so ridiculously over in love.
Yes. And yet, here we are starting off with two quite different people in love all over again, aren't we? Aren't we?
No.
Yes.
We're not in love all over again, and you know it. Good night, Amanda.
Oh, well, here, don't leave me. We won't talk about ourselves anymore. Talk about outside things, anything, honey. Stay with me till I pull myself together.
Very well.
What have you been doing lately, during these last years?
I went around the world, you know, after...
Yes, yes, of course I know. How was it?
The world?
Yes.
Very enjoyable.
China must be very interesting.
Very big, China.
And Japan?
Very small.
Did you eat shark's fins and take your shoes off and use chopsticks and everything?
Practically everything.
And India? The burning ghats or ghats or whatever they are, and the Taj Mahal. How was the Taj Mahal?
Unbelievable. A sort of dream.
That was the moonlight, I expect. Of course, you saw it in the moonlight.
Yes. Moonlight can be cruelly deceptive.
And it didn't look like a biscuit box, did it? You know, I've always felt that it might.
Darling, I do love you so.
I do hope you met a sacred elephant. They're lint white, I believe, and very, very sweet.
I've never loved anybody else for an instant. And you love me too, don't you? There isn't any doubt about it anywhere, is there?
No. No doubt anywhere.
You're looking very lovely in this damned moonlight, Amanda. Your skin is clear and cool and your eyes are shining. And you're growing lovelier and lovelier every second as I look at you. You don't hold any mystery for me, darling. Do you mind? There isn't a particle of you that I don't know, remember, and want. More than any desire in the world, deep down in my deepest heart, I want you back again. Please.
Don't say any more. You're making me cry so dreadfully.
Gertie followed Private Lives with four other straight plays, and then she went to work for Charles B. Cochran in a musical play called Nymph Errant, adapted from a novel by James Lever with songs by Cole Porter.
Once I loved such a shattering physician, quite the best-looking doctor in the state. He looked after my physical condition, and his bedside manner was great. When I'd gaze up and see him there above me, looking less like a doctor than a Turk, I was tempted to whisper, "Do you love me? Or do you merely love your work?" He said my bronchial tubes were entrancing. My epiglottis filled him with glee. He simply loved my larynx and went wild about my pharynx, but he never said he loved me. He said my epidermis was darling and found my blood as blue as could be. He went through wild ecstatics when I showed him my lymphatics, but he never said he loved me. And though no doubt it was not very smart of me, I kept on racking my soul to figure out why he loved every part of me. And yet not me as a whole. By my esophagus he was ravished, enthusiastic to a degree. He said 'twas just enormous, my appendix vermiformis, but he never said he loved me.
A Nymph Errant was the story of a schoolgirl on her way home from school in Switzerland who decides to experiment a little with life. Well, her experiments lead her into fantastic adventures and curious places, including a Turkish harem, but she arrives home at the end still wide-eyed and unaware of all the risks she's run. Now, here's another song out of Nymph Errant we can't leave out. Experiment.
Experiment. Make it your motto day. experiment, and it will lead you to the light. The apple on the top of the tree is never too high to achieve. Just take an example from Eve experiment. Be curious, though interfering friends may frown. Get furious at each attempt to hold you down. If this advice you'll only employ, the future can offer you infinite joy and merriment. Experiment, and you'll see.
Be curious, so interfering friends may come. Get furious, and each attempt to hold you down. If this advice you only
by now, Gertrude's extravagance had caught up with her. She owed a mountain of tax, both in this country and in the United States. And there was an impressive list of other creditors. They all pounced at once, and she was forced into bankruptcy. A pathetic diary entry of that time reads, "Haven't a bob or an ounce of strength after 6 days in bed with a temperature. Have a nurse, but heaven knows who'll pay her. Picture doesn't start for a week." Well, stripped of her cars, her flat, her jewelry, her furs, she began a frenzied round of work to get herself on her feet again. While working in the theatre at night, she was at the film studio all day. During her career, she made quite a number of films. She was essentially a stage artist, and one may guess that the main attraction filming had for her was the money. Nevertheless, several of her film performances were outstanding. Still remembered is her performance in Rembrandt, opposite Charles Laughton, and in later years, in The Glass Menagerie. 2 years of grueling work and Gertrude seemed free from debt. Among her engagements in the course of that 2 years, she starred with Douglas Fairbanks, Jr. in a play by Clements Dane, Moonlight is Silver.
Why did you never tell me that Charles Lancaster was in love
with him? He never was.
He told me he was tonight.
Oh, Steve. Besides, what does it matter as long as I'm not in love with him?
But you were in love with him once.
I tell you I wasn't.
Don't lie. What's the good of lying? That doesn't do us any good. I don't have to be sheltered. I shan't lose. Now, don't you understand that I don't care if you did once love Charles. I don't expect to be the only person you've ever cared for. Anyway, it isn't so, is it? Whatever I've expected. Only why didn't you tell me when you found yourself next door to the Lancasters that there was that in the background?
Did I tell you?
Not a word. You never told me a word. You never gave me a hint of it. Let me leave you here. You and Charles are here together, day in and day out, for 3 months, always together, till his own wife gets jealous. And you tell me about that. But you never told me that if I hadn't turned up in Bermuda, you'd have married Charles. Be honest, Joe. Be honest.
Oh, all right, I'll be honest. I might have. I did once think of it. But I was never in love with him.
We are husband and wife. We've got to live our lives together, bed and board, till one or the other of us dies. You suppose that if anything ever comes of this, that I'd ever let you go? But there's got to be the truth between us. If you've been deceiving me, tell me.
No, no.
Your eyes are full of tears. The very tears that are blinding.
Stop it.
Insincere, isn't that part of your charm? Do you dare to tell me that I've held you? How can I believe that? So you've been unfaithful to me, is that it?
No, it's not true. I tell you, it's none of it true. Tina, I'm in love with you.
After Moonlight at Silver, Gertrude worked again with Noel Coward in a series of 9 one-act plays which he'd written and arranged into 3 triple bills under the title Tonight at 8:30. They were played at the Phoenix Theatre in London and afterwards in New York. In one of the Tonight at 8:30 plays, Red Peppers, Gertie's early experiences in tatty touring companies stood her in very good stead. It was a sad but entertaining story of a fading man and wife variety act.
Yeah, I'm sick of you and the old act. It's lousy anyway.
The act was good enough for my mum and dad. It's good enough for you.
Yeah. Things have changed, you know, a bit since your mum and dad's day. There's electric light now and telephones. A little invention called the moving pictures. I mean, nobody wants to see the red peppers for $3 when they can have Garbo for ninth.
That's just where you're wrong, see? We're flesh and blood, we are. The public would rather see flesh and blood any day than a cheesy photograph. Put Garbo on a Saturday night in Devonport and see what had happened to her.
Yeah, you ought to know. Look what happened to us.
That wasn't Devonport, it was Southsea.
Well, whatever it was, the fleet was in.
If you think the acts are lousy, it's a pity you don't rewrite some of it.
Ever try going into St. Paul's and offering to rewrite the Bible?
Oh, very funny. Very, 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 very funny. You're wasted in the show business, dear. You ought to write for comic cuts, you ought.
I could think I'd better gags than you at that. That wasn't a lady, it was my wife. Or the old chestnut. Well, they were has-beens when your grandmother fell off the eye wire.
And what, may I ask, has my grandmother got to do with it?
Only that she didn't fall soon enough, that's all.
Red peppers, 3 minutes.
We're off. Here, hurry.
Oh, come on, come on. Don't keep the customers waiting.
You got your cane?
Yes, I've got it.
Well, don't drop it.
Oh, all right.
Well, you can imagine how Gertie enjoyed playing in that. She was an inveterate practical joker. In fact, in her Charlotte days, she got into a lot of trouble for it. Sir Cedric Hardwick remembers a practical joke which he once played on her. It was shortly after Tonight at 8:30 when she was touring in the United States in a play by Rachel Crothers called Susan and God. Sir Cedric tells the story.
We were playing next door to one another in the two theaters in Chicago. She was playing in Susan and God, and I was doing a play, Shadow and Substance. She'd had a most successful run, and on her last performance, it was arranged that I would go on in my priest's robes. I was playing a high priest in the Catholic Church with some flowers. Well, I forgot the flowers, and so I used some property flowers we used in the play, which were made, I think, of iron or some kind of metal. And I walked onto the stage at the end of the play when she was taking her curtain calls, and she turned around and thought that probably a very high dignitary of the church in Chicago had come to pay tribute to her. This didn't disturb her in the very least. But she picked up these iron flowers and started to throw them into the audience. I'm quite sure that several of the audience were brained by this.
After Susan and God, Gertie went into another straight play, Skylark, by Samuel Raphaelson. Now, to get this into shape, she played it at a summer theatre at Dennis on Cape Cod. The theatre director there was Richard Aldrich, who was to become her second husband. They were married on July the 4th, 1940, and their marriage was to be a very happy one. I am so glad that we've been able to get Mr. Aldrich to make a contribution to this program, and here he is.
On this very special occasion, I should like to quote a few lines from my book, Gertrude Lawrence as Mrs. A. It wasn't exactly her beauty in the conventional sense. Gertrude had something far more arresting and more unforgettable than beauty, a vitality, a zest for life that brought a glow to all who stood in her presence. Nor was it just a theatrical gift. It was the very essence of her whole being. The word that comes closest to it is radiance.
When they returned from their honeymoon, Gertie began rehearsals for a Broadway show that was to be one of the outstanding successes of her career. Lyrics by Ira Gershwin, music by Kurt Weill, book by Moss Hart. It was Lady in the Dark.
There once was a girl named Jenny, whose virtue
shoes were buried and many, excepting that she was inclined always to make up her mind. And Jenny points a moral with which we cannot quarrel, as you will find. Jenny made her mind up when she was three. She herself was going to trim the Christmas tree. Christmas Eve, she lit the candle, threw the tapers away. Little Jenny was an orphan on Christmas Day. Jenny made her mind up when she was 12 that into foreign languages she would delve. But at 17 to Bethel, it was quite a blow that in 27 languages she couldn't say no.
Poor Jenny, bright as a penny, her equal would be hard to find.
To Jenny I'm beholden, her heart was big and golden, but she wouldn't make up her mind.
Lady in the Dark ran for 2 years. After the first night, Broadway's senior dramatic critic, Brooks Atkinson, observed, "As for Gertrude Lawrence, she's a goddess. That's all." An amusing side note on Gertie's character is recalled by her chauffeur, Roosevelt. With Gertie, it was a case of love me, love my dog. Her dog was a Scottie called Angus.
Angus was her pride and joy, and it was my duty to keep him happy while she was on stage. There was a few times there when the weather was quite bad. It was a question as to whether I would take Mr. Orges to the barber or should I take Angus for a drive and take him to the, what I generally call Dog's Beauty Parlor, but actually was the pet shop to get a bath and get him keyed up. Angus won. I took Angus to the dog shop, but Mr. Orges had to hoof it. I don't think he was any too pleased about it, but it certainly pleases Angus.
During the war, all Gertie's spare time was devoted to British war charities. In 1944, she crossed the Atlantic to work for ENSA in Britain and in the newly liberated territories of France and Belgium. Europe to the Pacific to play for the United States forces in that war zone. Then she returned to New York and appeared in several plays, including a revival of Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion. In 1948, she made what was to be her last appearance here in London, in Septembertide, by Daphne du Maurier. Tell me, Mr. Maurier, had you met Gertie before she came into the cast of Septembertide?
No, I never had. She was in the last play my father did before he died, you know, and somehow I don't think I was around at the time, and I don't remember meeting her.
What was your reaction when you heard she was going to play the lead?
Well, I was a little bit staggered because it wasn't exactly my idea, and I wondered what it would be like. But then, when she did come to play it, I hadn't any fears at all. She was absolutely right. And she was wonderful at rehearsals, though sometimes a little bit temperamental, perhaps, and at other times, absolutely wonderful. Terrific trooper, always.
Thank you, Daphne du Maurier. After a very successful run at the Aldrich Theatre, Gertie returned to the United States. Her previous appearance there in Pygmalion had given her an exciting idea. Her personal manager, Fanny Holtzman, tells us about it.
The success of My Fair Lady is particularly gratifying to those of us who know that as far back as the early 40s, Gertrude Lawrence originated the idea of having Shaw's Pygmalion made into a musical. Shaw pooh-hoohed the idea, said it was ridiculous, and refused to grant the rights because, he said, his play, which he described to us as a potboiler done to rags, would not be accepted by the present-day public either with or without music. However, he did finally relent and permitted Gertrude to do Pygmalion in America. Throughout this time, Gertrude never abandoned the idea for the musical Pygmalion. She made slow progress in her campaign to obtain the rights. It was not until after Shaw had passed away that Gertrude, through Gabriel Pascal, succeeded. Gertrude made one provision, that the play open in London, its proper environment.
We were never to see Gertie in that musical version of Pygmalion, but she was to appear in one more musical show at the St. James's Theatre, New York, on the 29th of March, 1951, The King and I. Co-starring with Gertrude Lawrence in The King and I was Yul Brynner.
There's only one thing that always comes to mind when anyone asks me about Gertrude Lawrence. And that is the way I saw her the first time on the stage. To me, then and ever since, even when I worked with her, she was a completely magic apparition. This magic is not something that can be explained. Only one clue comes to mind. She has the most extraordinary love for her audiences. I've never seen that in anyone like it was in Gertie. When the curtain would come down, she would turn around to me, and listening to the applause behind the curtain, out in the audience, she would smile, and she would almost blow a kiss to the audience before the curtain went up again. I think this was one of the great secrets of the great warmth that she had, that everybody felt. She loved them, and they always loved her. And so did we.
Gertrude Lawrence played in The King and I for over a year and a quarter. Then she was taken ill and died only 3 weeks after leaving the show. On the day of her funeral, the theatre lights of London and Broadway were dimmed for 2 minutes of curtain time. Thus, the theatre paid a last tribute to one of its most beloved stars and most devoted servants.
Brave young lovers and follow your star. Be brave.
And so ends this recording of the Gertrude Lawrence story, written by Roy Plumley and told by Hugh Sinclair. In this program, you heard the voices of Pamela Clatworthy, her daughter, Fanny Holtzman, her business manager, Roosevelt, her chauffeur, Yul Brynner, Daphne du Maurier, Sir Cedric Hardwick, Claude Halbert, Beatrice Lilly, Roy Royston, and Richard Aldrich. The singers were Harry Dawson and the Linden Singers. The orchestra, the BBC Variety Orchestra, led by Frank Stewart, under its conductor, Paul Fennelly. The Gertrude Lawrence story was produced by Michael North.